You're listening to a hearing into discrimination and violence against ethnic and religious minorities in the wake of September 11th. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests.
Good afternoon.
Hello. My name is Mohammed Hamli. I'm a U.S. citizen and I am 12 years old. I will be speaking today on the behalf of my family. My family came to the United States in 1992. 3 months later, my father left his job as a pilot for the Syrian president and was able to escape Syria and make it to our new home in America where freedom truly exists. We applied for asylum, got our work permits, and paid for our taxes. Not once did we break the law. We were young and did not know what was going on, but we were happy that my family was alive and with us. It's heartbreaking that such a beautiful country with such wonderful people can have such a hideous and gruesome government. I hope with all my heart that America does not join the club that throws its people into jail for who they are and what they believe in. Then September 11th came along. It was a day of horror and heroism. It was a day that changed America and a nightmare that has not yet ended. On February 22nd, 2002, something happened I never thought possible. For after all, this is America. Yet, that morning at 5 a.m., something did occur that would severely revolutionize our life forever. My parents and my sister were stolen away from us. About 7 FBI and INS agents barged into our once wonderful home and dragged them out of bed with guns and flashlights. Now my sister and I have been scattered among homes waiting to see our parents come home in Linwood. I couldn't have even imagined this 1 year ago, but now it's something that I replay every day of my life. My mother, my father, and my 20-year-old sister have been suffering tremendously during their 8-month detention. My mother currently suffers from Crohn's disease. It's a very bad intestinal infection that does not have a cure. She keeps a very strict diet that she has been taken to the hospital too many times, and this proves that they are not providing the proper diet or treatment. Recently, the INS, who I believe caused and ignored a lump in her breast. Her health is drastically deteriorating. My mother honestly believes that if she isn't out of there soon, she will die. My sister suffers from severe kidney stones. She misses food, her bed, her family, and her freedom. It breaks her heart that a country that she loves and calls home since she was 9 years old is making her family go through this just because they're Arab Muslims. As for my father, he left Syria from injustice to find himself locked up in a country that he loves. He kept saying there's justice in this country. I hope justice shows up at our doorstep soon. They feed them oatmeal in the morning, a cup of noodle at lunch and dinner. I don't know if you guys have ever heard someone crying of hunger. Well, we do every time we talk to them on the phone. Putting all that aside for now, there's even a bigger dilemma. Two federal courts have found serious legal and constitutional questions concerning the case of my family. This includes claims under the Convention Against Torture and Ineffective Assistance of Counsel. Three expert witnesses have concluded that my family will be tortured and possibly killed if they return to Syria. Without immediate attention, my family will remain in custody at the INS facilities. The INS should stop trying every effort to deport my family and reconsider the instant release of my family. I condemn and hold the INS liable for exceeding the bounds of human dignity and justice with unlawful and callous detention of my family. I abhor the abusive mistreatment and the crude measures used by the INS to crush our spirit. I demand that my family be released immediately as mandated by the law in accordance with the respect for human dignity, human rights, and American law, if not anything for the sake of us kids. The family should be reunited, so please help. I don't know what I have to lose. I don't want to lose my parents, but I don't want to lose my dad to the government and my mother to illness. They're too good of people to suffer this much. God bless you, and God bless America.
My name is Ricardo Ortega, and I work for Norway's Labor and Employment Law Office. I work with some of the families who has been affecting for the poorer rates in the airport of SeaTac. Early this year, Operation Tarmac Records Review put in place to improve security in the airports because of the terrorist attacks, led to the indiscriminate suite in which many people lost their jobs in surprise raids. The INS pursued some employers in SeaTac to collaborate with them, calling phony meetings, dressing up in their employees' uniforms. I want to read this testimony from one person who is afraid to be here and speak out. The INS went to my job and took my papers. Then they come to my house to pick me out. My husband, my cousin, and my three young daughters were there. They looked through my papers, identification, and personal belongings. They deported my cousins. They then deported my cousins to my country. This deeply affect my entire family. I feel sad, and I feel as I throw this is my fault, because I was working to feed my family, to put a roof over their heads. My husband, my three young daughters, and I were given a court appointment. We went to the court where they decided to deport me to my country. I was given the day when I am voluntarily leave this country. If I leave this country, I will suffer a lot in my country. But if I stay here, I am not in compliance with the rule and regulation of the INS. In order to avoid this deep suffering of separation of whole families, created by the deportation and recognize the right dimension of the value of workers, of immigrant workers, we demand the general amnesty and regularization for all immigrant workers. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for your solidarity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Nassim Tafarha. I'm the director of the Seattle chapter of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. I'll also read testimony on behalf of somebody who was too fearful to publicly give this testimony, and I'll shorten some of the comments in the interest of time. But what I will focus on is this idea that using racial profiling is an effective tool to make Americans safer. And that's an idea that I think there's a serious issue with. People in our community feel like there's a set of standards that apply to them that don't apply to others. They feel like they're presumed guilty until proven innocent, and they feel like they have the burden of walking around trying to prove that they have no real connection to 19 hijackers who happen to share the same ethnic or religious background as they do. This burden is not reasonable, and it's really unfair. And I want to reiterate that it doesn't make us more safe. An example, just last month, there was an uncovering of a very sophisticated and sinister plot to blow up a mosque and hundreds of its worshipers in Florida. And that illustrates the shortcomings of the use of racial profiling to prevent acts of domestic terrorism. The accused individual didn't fit the profile of a perceived terrorist. Hence, he was not under surveillance by the FBI. And this plot was uncovered because it was only after his wife called local law enforcement to report that he had threatened to kill her, and a search of the home was performed, and then they uncovered the plans. So I'd like to read the testimony of one of those locally who was interviewed by the FBI. He was lucky enough not to be detained, and he agonized over whether to come here and speak for himself. But in the end, he decided that it was best for he and his family that he does not do that. Here's his statement. I immigrated to the United States over 8 years ago with hopes of completing my college degree and consequently having the opportunity for building a better future for my family and myself. I have always been active in my community, and I never faced any discrimination or bias. And the fact that I was an Arab and a Muslim was never a negative factor. After September 11th, things changed dramatically for Muslim and Arab Americans. Blamed for sharing the religion and nationality of the terrorists, men with whose characteristics were targeted and sought out for questioning. As I read about the thousands of men who were rounded up after September 11th, I never suspected that I would be included. It was not until I applied for permanent residency status that I learned that the FBI was seeking me for questioning. After months of delay for paperwork, my lawyer uncovered the reason for the postponement. The INS could not find me, and the FBI was holding my file along with hundreds of other files belonging to students that had emigrated in recent years from Middle Eastern countries. A 45-minute telephone interview ensued, in which I was asked if I was a terrorist. Had I been located earlier, I would have most likely been jailed and interviewed personally until I could be cleared. I have never had any connection to any terrorist organization and never violated the law or went out of status. I was sought only because of my nationality and my religion. My situation is small compared to the many stories of discrimination and injustice that occur every day against Arabs and Muslims in the United States. Most immigrants came to the United States to flee persecution in their own countries, and yet now they are targeted and viewed as a threat by the country that promised them freedom and acceptance. Islam is a peace-loving religion, and to categorize Muslims as terrorists is an injustice. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. My name is Abdel Nasser Ali Noor. I'm a manager and a partner of the Makkah Mini Market located in Rainier Valley. Approximately 8 o'clock a.m. in the morning on November 7, 2001, a federal agency raided my store. I came to my store. I was personally searched, although I was quickly released. Before I came to the store, half of my groceries were loaded on a truck, as well as my coolers and my shelf units. I was given no explanation for the raid. I later found out that the real target of the raid was a money wiring transfer in my store. Although we have a different business license, different name of the business. The federal agency dumped everything that's perishable in my store, and they have not yet paid. The store suffered a serious damage point. When the government finally allowed me to reopen, I had no groceries and much smaller customers for the business. Like me, such a loss, a lot of business, and for the small business like me, such a loss are terrible and have not yet recovered. Unfortunately, the problem did not end. After my store reopened, I received a letter from the USDA charging me food stamp fraud or food stamp trafficking. And later, on suspend my ability to accept food stamp. Most of my customers are low-income families who depend on food stamp, so my business effectively shut down. Two other Somali stores as well. Happily, after near 5 months, I received a news that USDA has reversed their decision to disqualify us. Although I pleased the outcome, I am very worried that my business and my reputation have been badly damaged or hurt. I have paid emotional toll after September 11. I have now accused twice wrongdoing that I have not committed. This feels very bad to me and my community. Thank you all.
Buenas tardes, mi nombre es Ana María Rivera.
Good afternoon, my name is Ana María Rivera.
Yo nací en Ensenada, México, y estoy en Estados Unidos desde 1998.
I was born in Ensenada, Mexico, and have lived in the United States since 1998.
Soy una mujer inmigrante que ha sobrevivido la violencia doméstica.
I am an immigrant woman who has survived domestic violence.
Cuando estuve casada con mi esposo Carlos, fui abusada física y emocionalmente.
While I was married to my husband Carlos, I was physically and emotionally abused many times.
Hasta que tuve el valor de salir de la violencia doméstica.
Until I got the courage to leave the domestic violence situation.
Recibí mucha ayuda para salir adelante, yo y mis hijos.
I got a lot of help to get ahead and change my life for me and my children.
Ahora tengo un trabajo y tengo mis papeles para estar legalmente en este país.
I now have a job and papers to be legally in this country.
Muchas mujeres inmigrantes en mi situación, cuando no tenía papeles, no llamábamos a la policía por temor a ser deportadas.
Many immigrant women in my situation, when they don't have papers, don't call the police because they are afraid of being deported.
Cuando dejé a mi esposo y estuve en un shelter y conocí todas las leyes en este país.
When I left my husband and was staying at a shelter and learned about all the laws in this country.
Conocí muchas cosas y entre ellas que la policía no puede fungir como migración.
I learned a lot of things, among them that in this country the police cannot act to deport you.
Porque se supone que la policía está aquí para ayudarnos.
Because the police is supposed to be here to help us.
Ahora tristemente estoy escuchando que la policía quiere, perdón, que migración quiere darle el poder a la policía para trabajar como migración.
Now, sadly, I hear that immigration wants to give police the power to act as immigration agents.
Esto va a crear una situación más tensa para nosotras las mujeres que atravesamos violencia doméstica.
This is going to create a more tense and difficult situation for those of us immigrant women in domestic violence situations.
Ya que de por sí tenemos el temor de la policía, de migración, y ahora de que la policía va a trabajar como migración.
Because as it is, we're afraid of police and afraid of immigration. And now that the police will be afraid that the police will act as immigration agents.
Yo podría decir muchas cosas, pero tenemos muy poco tiempo. El motivo de que yo estoy aquí es para pedir a nuestro gobierno que no le dé el poder a la policía para trabajar como migración.
I could say a lot of things, but we don't have much time. I'm basically here to ask that the government not give the police the power to act as immigration agents.
Porque también le van a dar a nuestros maridos. Porque también le van a dar el poder a nuestros esposos de agarrar un bat y darnos por otro lado.
Because that is at the same time giving our husbands the power to pick up a bat and hit us up the side of the head.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Hillary Hahn, and I'm an immigration attorney. I'm testifying today on behalf of my client, Elias Glacia. He's a 28-year-old Tunisian man. And for the past year, my partner Vicky Dobrin and I have been representing him. Elias has been in this country since 1998 and is married to a United States citizen. Prior to September 11th, Elias had never been arrested in any country nor accused of committing any crimes. Today, he's been in jail for more than a year solely because of unsupported allegations by a former roommate. Elias is a devout Muslim. Last summer, he was living in Tacoma with two fellow Tunisians. A woman named Ann Anderson and her son, Chris, stayed with them for 6 weeks. At the beginning of September, Elias and his roommates asked them to leave since they had to vacate the apartment at the end of the month. Then September 11th happened. On September 14th, Ann made a report to a police officer. According to this report, Ann said that Elias was a Muslim extremist who had expressed his approval of the September 11th attacks. She allegedly told the officer that Elias talked about, quote, killing more Americans. The report also said that Anne overheard him talking on the telephone in Arabic. Although she didn't understand Arabic, she claimed to hear mixed-in references to in English to blowing up the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in the INS building. A day later, she seemingly disappeared. Elias was arrested by the INS on September 16th. For the first week or week and a half of his detention, he was held in solitary confinement. When interviewed, he categorically denied making the statements alleged in the police report. The FBI also interviewed Elias. This interview lasted just 10 or 15 minutes. Again, Elias denied ever having made the statements. They've never gone back to interview Elias. They've never interviewed Ann Anderson. And they have never brought any kind of criminal or material witness charges against Elias. Elias was placed in deportation proceedings. The INS has never formally charged him with being a terrorist. However, they have said that the allegations in the police report make Elias a danger to the national security, and that he should not be released from INS detention during his deportation proceedings. INS made little effort to find Ann Anderson, and they presented no other evidence that Elias was a danger to the national security. The immigration judge agreed with the INS, saying that because a police report was made by a police officer, it was true. Meanwhile, Elias applied for asylum. The Tunisian government arrests and tortures many deeply religious young Muslim men because they fit the government's profile of a terrorist. Elias is at even greater risk because he's already been accused by the United States government of being a danger to the national security. A professor at the University of Washington testified and confirmed that Elias is at risk of torture if he goes back to Tunisia. Then in April of this year, before the immigration judge made a final decision, a private investigator hired by somebody in the community found Ann Anderson. When asked about the police report, she said that she had not said those things, and that, more importantly, they were not true. She testified before the immigration judge and again strongly denied that Elias had ever made the statements alleged in the police report. Her son Chris also testified and said exactly the same thing. After Anne testified, the immigration judge denied Elias' request for asylum and he ordered him deported to Tunisia. He said that he still believed that the allegations were true and that Elias is a danger to national security and someone who is likely to engage in, quote, terrorist activities in the United States. Today, more than 1 year after his arrest, Elias remains in INS detention as he appeals the immigration judge's decisions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Lina Khalaftofaha, and I work with the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. While many public officials are quick to condemn hate crimes and discrimination, we call to your attention today the fact that the actions of the government have created a general climate where racial profiling and discrimination are tolerated and perpetuated in airports, on the streets, in the workplace, and in our own neighborhoods. According to the Labor and Immigration Organizing Network, discrimination in the workplace increased dramatically after September 11th. Employers have been quick to call in the FBI or the INS or to fire workers for minor incidents. Government actions have directly contributed to this. For example, the Social Security Administration, SSA, has stepped up its No Match program, which informs employers of Social Security numbers that don't match its database. In the recent past, the SSA has sent out about 40,000 No Match letters. This year, it is sending approximately 750,000. The result has been a surge in the number of workers being fired because they are suspected of not having proper documentation, even though the letter itself notes that a mismatch is not sufficient cause for firing a worker. In the wake of September 11th, many states are considering measures that would deny immigrants access to driver's licenses. During the most recent state legislative sessions, including here in Washington State, approximately 46 bills were introduced that sought to restrict immigrants' ability to get driver's licenses. Most of these bills were put forth in the name of anti-terrorism measures. These measures change the fundamental purpose of a driver's license from a document that shows that a driver knows the rules of the road to a national identification card. They will force immigrants who must use a car to do so without testing, licensure, and without insurance. The criminal justice system, which was already focused disproportionately on communities of color, began to show renewed signs of racial profiling and disproportionate treatment, particularly to Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian men. Immigrant communities of color became the target of increased suspicion and harsher treatment by police officers, the courts, and related government agencies, such as the Child Protective Services. All of these actions attest to a climate of increased discrimination and fear facing immigrant communities of color. When our federal and state governments engage in such actions as racial profiling, indiscriminate arrests, and secret detentions, it creates the space and sets the tone for businesses and employers and indeed communities and neighborhoods to engage in racist, discriminatory, and dangerous behavior. The next testimonies will highlight these practices and their impacts on our communities.
Good afternoon. My name is Noor, and I'm from Afghanistan. I came here 2 years ago as a political asylum. And it was on July 13, me and my girlfriend, who's an American citizen, we went for a weekend getaway to Lake Moses.
A little closer to the mic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Which is located in eastern Washington. And we went there camping. As soon as we tried to put up the tent, there was like 40 people. They said it's okay to camp here. It was all white people. And as soon as I tried to put up the tent, the sheriff pulled over. And because we look foreigners, he asked us to leave. So when I asked him why, he said it's a private land and we can't camp there. Then he assumed we were drinking and he was going to give my girlfriend a ticket. So I said, okay, we haven't been drinking and we're going to leave if it's private land. So then he says, oh, can I see your ID, sir? So I show them my ID. My name is in Middle Eastern and my license. So as soon as I gave him my ID, he looked at my ID and he says, oh, you're under arrest, sir. I was like, for what? What'd I do? Obstructing a police officer, which we didn't even do anything. So he arrested me. He didn't even let me put on some clothes. He arrested me actually with my swimming suit, which was just underwear. So he took me to jail. Then he took my license. He never gave my license back to me. Then I was in jail for 2 days. They thought I was some sort of illegal alien until they called immigration and they came and I was bond out. The police never gave my license back, and also he had a way to get inside my political asylum case. I don't know how. He found out everything, how I came to the United States, what was my case all about. A sheriff. He had gone into my case, and also while he had all the information, he called the jail and he said, oh, this guy is illegal. So I stayed 2 days in jail. I bond up for $500, then I went to court to fight my case. My lawyer advised me that if I fight my case, take it to trial, and I lose it, then I'm gonna face immigration consequences, then I will be deported back to Afghanistan. So I took the lesser charges. I plea bargained for lesser charges. I was fined $500, paid $500 to the lawyer, but it's not the money that I paid at. Now, I'm gonna go for my entry for green card in about a few months, and this is in my record. And the immigration, as soon as they look at this, they're gonna put me back in jail, that little stinky jail that they have in downtown. I don't know if you guys have seen it, they have this really nasty, dirty jail in downtown airport way. So I'm gonna go there and they can't deport me back to Afghanistan because Afghanistan doesn't have a legitimate government. So I'm gonna be staying there for at least 2-3 years until Afghanistan have a legitimate government, then they can deport me back for something we didn't even do. And I feel this was a clear attack by police over my religion, nationality, and even though a crime was committed against me, I had to plead guilty to crime that I did not commit. I did this because I was afraid of the immigration consequences, that I would be deported because of these charges. I feel this is really unfair. I should be able to go to trial and fight my case without the fear that I would lose my life and air in the United States. The only reason I came to America is to have freedom, civil rights, human rights, which we didn't have in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, our rights were people were abused by Talibans. I mean, I've lost family members, I've lost my father, I've lost three uncles, I've lost three cousins, I've lost my niece by Taliban regimes, and they were killed right in front of my eyes. I've been myself tortured, beaten by Talibans in my head with AK-74. And that's why I came to America, to at least have. I did not come to America for a good life. I came here to live as a human, because we did not have the right in Afghanistan. But now I'm facing all these charges, and all my future has been destroyed now because of just this little thing, and we didn't even do it. So I think I'm asking the legislators, the lawmakers, to give the immigrants a little right to at least fight their case, to take it to trial without the fear of the immigration laws and regulations. This way we lose, and we're gonna... I should have put that little thing right there. So this way we can have some rights to fight our cases and stand up for our rights, because this is the only reason we came to America. And that's all I'm asking you guys. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Susan Foster, and I'm a partner with the law firm of Perkins Coie. In April of this year, I had the opportunity to represent three local Somali halal grocers who had been charged with food stamp trafficking and disqualified from the USDA food stamp program. Local Somalis had been the subject of governmental action previously, and community members expressed concern that the community was being targeted based upon their religion and ethnicity. Based upon my experience as counsel in the subsequent USDA appeal, I have to concur. There is, in fact, a different set of rules being applied to those who are suspect simply because of their race, religion, or ethnicity. I would like to play for you now an excerpt from a USDA interview of Mr. Nur prior to his disqualification. Please remember that there has never been any allegation that he is a terrorist or has any terrorist affiliation. In this excerpt that we're going to play, Mr. Nur has stepped out of the room, leaving the USDA officials to confer amongst themselves.
Before we go any further, I just want to...
He stepped out for just a moment, Fred.
Oh, he did?
He wants to get a letter.
Oh.
Getting it from Ben.
Do you think they're on the
Maybe a bomb or something in it.
Maybe he has a bomb in it or something. These officials were there to hear his explanations and assess his guilt or innocence. But in their mind, he wasn't simply a small business owner. He was a Somali Muslim and thus suspect of being a bomb-carrying terrorist. Mr. Nur's explanations regarding Somali culture and purchasing habits were going to fall on deaf ears. And indeed, as this next excerpt shows, the fundamental due process right that we all have to be presumed innocent until proven guilty simply was not applied in this case.
Yeah, okay, I understand. It is not illegal for us, he said, to check by telephone for the person if they had.
No, the trafficking in food stamps is illegal, and you have not proven yet that you haven't been doing that.
So you say that again, sir?
I said, no, you're right. What you just said is not illegal. However, trafficking in food stamps is illegal, and you have not yet proven that you have not been trafficking.
Well, in this biased environment, he was unable to prove his case.
Before we go any further, I just want to...
Cut the tape, please. In this biased environment, he was unable to prove his innocence, and he was, in fact, disqualified. Even on appeal, these grocers were dealt with disparate treatment. They were denied fundamental due process rights, such as the very right to review the evidence presented against you. In this case, unlike most cases, we were denied the full report that was sent to the administrative review officers. USDA officials expressed some surprise at this. However, the official USD report was to deny that information to us. Our FOIA request, seeking information for which we could defend our client and also to determine the basis for this governmental action, were also not dealt with the same as they would be in other cases. Our requests were had documents withheld, and even the very tape that you heard was not initially provided to us. Only because we saw a reference to it in another document and we asked about it, where we provided a tape. That tape was of such poor quality that we had to use internal and external resources to enhance that tape, only to find out it was the wrong tape. Then we got this one. We've had targeted governmental action, biased enforcement, a lack of due process, and a lack of fundamental fairness and due process, all conducted behind a veil of secrecy. The question that must be answered in this and other cases, what is the specific governmental directive that has authorized, condoned, and allowed this type of treatment? What is the government going to do to ensure that our community does not continue to live in fear? An open government allows these questions to be asked. An open government gives you the documents that you can debate these questions and answer these questions. To paraphrase a recent judicial decision, difficult times such as these have always tested our fidelity to the core democratic values of openness, government accountability, and the rule of law. But it's perhaps even more important at such times to allow our system of justice to work so as to ensure that our government always operates within the statutory and constitutional constraints which distinguish a democracy from a dictatorship. With the assistance of the community, political leaders, local relief organizations, a large law firm, and even PricewaterhouseCoopers got involved here, we were able to reverse the disqualification decisions. But those types of resources are not going to be available to every individual who's the subject of governmental persecution. September 11th left us all feeling a deep and abiding sense of fear. I don't know if you remember last Sunday, but the prowlers went by the stadium. I was in my office building on the 43rd floor. I can tell you, as those engines came through, I and others in the building were shaking with fear. But I am shaking even more with a sense of fear that those fundamental core democratic values that I learned as a teenager and which led me to a choice of law are being trampled. That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that no person shall be denied life, liberty, property without due process of law, that justice is for all. I ask now that as we pursue security, that we also recognize that we need to renew our commitment to these principles so as to ensure that justice is, in fact, provided to all. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Hardeep Reki. I'm 24 years old. I was born and raised in Seattle. I'm a third-year law student at Tulane University. I received my undergraduate degree from Whitman College and went to high school here in Seattle at Bush School. I am a sick American, as are 99% of all Americans that wear turbans. Like all Americans, sick Americans have contributed richly to the workplace and the American in general. The first Asian American to become a congressman was a sick. The inventor of fiber optics that forms the heart of all telecommunications around the world is a sick American. The chief marketing officer for Palm Incorporated is a sick American. America's largest peach grower is a sick American. And last but not least, one of the first doctors to arrive on the scene and to treat victims of Ground Zero, and indeed a true hero of 9/11, is a sick American. Some fellow Americans, however, when they look at me or other Sikhs, don't always see a fellow American. Generally, I've always been treated differently. I've been pointed out and set apart in public places by both the general public and people with governmental authority. This is especially true at airports, where although they claim that all searches are random, I've been searched about 80% of the time that I've flown. I specifically remember sitting next to a lady, and she was saying she didn't quite understand why everybody was so upset about these searches, that it doesn't happen that frequently. I interrupted her and I asked her, how many times have you been searched? And she said once in the 3 or 4 round trips that she had taken. I told her I've been searched approximately 8 times in the 4 or 5 times that I've flown. Somehow it seems that the random number generator seems to pick 6 more frequently than any other community. But it's not even the searches that bother me. What bothers me is the way that these searches are perceived by the public. What bothers me the most is that when the public constantly sees a certain group of people being picked out of the crowd on a consistent basis, that they also become suspicious of that group. What I mean to say is that when you go to the airport and you see every time you go there you're confronted with a turban man being searched, it starts to perpetuate the stereotypes that exist. That certain perpetuates the stereotypes that turban people are bad, that turban people are terrorists, that turban people, for some reason, are deserving of higher scrutiny than other citizens. Ultimately, in the light of all the events that have occurred, in the face of all the harassment that I have personally faced, and that many that look similar to me have faced, I've had to change my view on what I once thought this country was all about. I had to change my thoughts about what I was born and raised believing American ideals were. At some point, and perhaps it was a bit naive, I believe there is no such thing as a second-class citizen. I'm living proof that there is such a class. Both the state and federal government, both the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch, are willing to give a false sense of security to the first-class citizens at the expense of a second-class citizen. Thank you.
My name is Asha Mohammed, and I'm here today on behalf of the Somali community. After September 11, the Somali were targeted. A few days after the attack, a 16-year-old Somali was attacked and stabbed in a gas station in West Seattle. A few days later, six Somali women were fired from their jobs. Our men are being harassed constantly from being Muslim and Somali. We are targeted by the media, by the citizen of this country, and almost we feel that we are back in Somalia with no voice and no right. Today, wearing a hijab, it has become a target of being a terrorist. Becoming a Muslim, it was a sense of peace, but today it means we are killers. We are not. We came here the same reason a lot of your ancestors came to the United States. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, but after September 11, we feel those rights have been taken away from us. Our girls, they cannot go out and shop because they are wearing the hijab. We are here in America, our new home, and we would like to tell our story, even though it's so painful, and I am only one person, but we're here, and we're here to stay. We are not terrorists, we are not murderers, but we're your neighbors, your schoolmates, your friends. Today we're pleading with you. A lot of Somali have been deported. A lot of us are in fear. Do something about it. Do something about it.
My name is Karen Yoshitomi, and I'm the regional director for the Japanese American Citizens League. Sorry.
Take your time.
60 years ago, our nation turned its back on nearly 120,000 people and put them in American concentration camps, isolation centers, and federal prisons, the sole basis of which was ancestry. In this country, equality, fairness, applies to all people, regardless of ancestry, nationality, or religion. The Bill of Rights are the central compact between the federal government and the people of this nation, rights which cannot be set aside without individual review and due process. Mako Nakagawa has spent a lifetime devoted to education and community involvement. This despite the fact that at 5 years of age, she was an internee in a war relocation assembly center, euphemistically called Camp Harmony. Camp Harmony. At six, she was a citizen exile at Minidoka, and by 7 years of age, she was a prisoner of war in a Department of Justice isolation and detention center in Crystal City, Texas. Malko is here today to share part of her personal story.
Well, the stories are particularly touching for me because for many of us in our community, we hear these stories and it is not again. We heard these stories 60 years ago. And if there was one legacy from our experience, we were hoping that the legacy is that it will never happen again. 60 years ago, 60 years ago, I learned to put my hand over my heart and pledge allegiance to the American flag with liberty and justice for all. Isn't it ironic that I learned those beautiful, ideal American words when I was a prisoner in America's concentration camp? Oh my goodness, 60 years ago, it never should have happened. And the stories, my story is old, not recent, but 60 years ago, the stories are about the same. The FBI and the Seattle police came to my father's house early in the morning, shoved my mother aside, stormed into the house, ransacked the closets, made a mess, watching my father as he forced him to do his morning toiletry as he was being observed. My mother yelled upstairs, get dressed to my older sister because she liked to sleep in the nude. But I guess the FBI did not know what she was saying in Japanese and they rushed upstairs drawing their guns. My sister remembers the FBI putting his hands into the sugar bowl and into the rice bins, and she was thinking, ooh, that's horrible. I remember that's the second time in my life I saw my mother cry. The first time was when Grandma died, but this time her cry was very different. It scared me. It scared me. That's the only thing I remember is the second time I saw my mother cry. My father was an optimist. This was on February 21, 1942. Two days after Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which ultimately was the order that got us incarcerated. 2 days after that, it was also the day of my oldest sister's 11th birthday. That's the day that it happened. That day is a big day in our family history. Our father was taken away, and after he was gone, the house was a mess. It was a mess. My father was an optimist, and he decided he'd do his best to cooperate, and maybe if he really did a good job of that, he can be home for dinner to have birthday cake with the family. Of course, that was never to be. He said the first time he did feel like maybe he would not be able to get back with the family is when he was forced to strip naked and they examined him. And he said the humiliation was such that he'll never forget. I could tell you story after story, but the point is the same stories are being told again today. That just cannot be, you know? Pramila said in her opening presentation that touched me, she said, we say we are not willing to sacrifice those principles of liberty, democracy, and equality that defines us as a great nation. The cost is far too high to pay. 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry paid that price in 1942. You must make sure it doesn't happen again. When we say justice for all, it must be justice for all. It's not all but them. Very, very few people stood up for us. We dearly remember those that did. But very, very few people stood up for us then. And there was not an audience like this for us at that time. But America needs us again. I love America. With all her faults, I love America. But I think you and I in the audience, and the commissioners over there, we must do our very best to make sure that we live up to all our beautiful American ideals for all, justice for all. Thank you.
You have heard today from a number of people whose lives have been dramatically affected by the events of September 11th. These are not the single stories that you hear or read in the media. These are people all over in all of our communities across America that are feeling these impacts. In many cases, they have been the victims of a coordinated government, a strategy that has ignored some of the fundamental rights that exist in our U.S. Constitution. We express today our deep concern regarding this assumption of new powers by the executive branch that poses risks to human rights and civil liberties, particularly when such powers have not been authorized by Congress and there has been no public debate concerning them. We hope that this event here is the first of many across the country. We hope that all of you who are in the audience, who have come forward in spite of such great fear, will know that you are supported, you are listened to, and your voices will be heard. All of our voices will be heard. We would like to present 10 recommendations that we are asking all of you as representatives, elected and appointed officials, local, state, and federal levels to acknowledge and act upon, and to present those 10 recommendations. These are recommendations that have been put together by a large number of communities, and we'd like to have the representatives of those communities come forward to tell you what they are.
We ask that our elected officials review with a critical eye any new legislation or policy that contributes to the climate of fear and discrimination. All actions that promote a sense of inclusion and contribute to a reduced climate of fear and discrimination should be actively pursued. At the federal level, establish a congressional oversight committee that can monitor the critical balance between security and civil rights, and that has authority over the actions of the Justice Department. We also endorse the proposal to create an Office of Civil Rights and Liberties with a Senate-confirmed director.
We call for federal, state, and local officials to actively pursue strategies to improve the cultural competence of all law enforcement and state agencies and to increase the representation of these communities in all agencies. We ask that individuals should not be targeted for investigation, detention, or selective enforcement of the laws because of their race, religion, ethnic background, or appearance, nor should they be denied employment because of their race, religion, or ethnic background.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Individuals should not be detained unless they are charged with either criminal or immigration violations. Individuals charged with crimes or immigration violations should not be arbitrarily detained before trial on such charges. All persons have a right to effective assistance of counsel. There should be no interference with the attorney-client privilege.
Secret evidence should not be used to deprive individual of their liberty or try them for violation of criminal or immigration laws. Due process protection must apply to any closure or wholesale seizure of the assets of any individual, businesses, charity, or religion organizations.
governmental compilation of databases on individuals can pose severe dangers to freedoms of association, religion, and speech, and the right to privacy. The government should not compile databases on individuals without procedures to protect against labeling them as suspected terrorists on the basis of their lawful religious or political activities, associations, race, religion, or ethnic background. We encourage everyone to engage in vigorous debate about the path on which the Bush administration is taking us. It is critical to engage with the communities represented here on a regular basis about the impact of continuing government actions and the pervasive climate of fear and discrimination.
You've been listening to a hearing held in Seattle, Washington on September 21st on ethnic and religious discrimination in America in the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. The hearings were organized by the Hate Free Zone of Washington, a coalition of over 100 community organizations. Thanks to Jonathan Lawson of the Seattle Independent Media Center for providing us with this material.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. The rich will come.